Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Master. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Dr. Robert Ebel about the recent revelations of competing secret plans for Iraqi oil, which were developed before the invasion of that country by the United States. And of course, this is the second anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War. And we'll be looking into whether these secret plans set the neoconservatives who wanted to use the Iraqi oil to destroy OPEC against the oil companies and the State Department pragmatists. And Dr. Ebel has been an oil specialist, an oil analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency for 11 years, and he spent over 7 years with the Office of Oil and Gas in the Department of the Interior, and he's now the chairman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Energy Program. We'll also talk with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who is the Peter Strauss Family Professor of Political Science at Yale University. We'll be talking to him about his sense that the Bush administration's plans to reverse or extinguish or expunge the legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt is by removing the social safety net such as Social Security. Is in fact what Dr. Hacker calls risk privatization. So we'll be looking into that thesis of his. And we'll also talk with Harvey Wasserman about recent comments made by Senator Robert Byrd on the floor of the Senate, where Senator Byrd made analogies with the Bush administration and the Bush administration's policies and the rise of fascism in Europe. Of course, these remarks by Senator Byrd were greeted by outrage from Republicans and from the surrogates in the television, radio, and cable television. I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Ebel, who, as I mentioned, is the chairman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Energy Program. He spent 11 years at the Central Intelligence Agency as an oil analyst and over 7 years with the Office of Oil and Gas in the Department of the Interior. And BBC Newsnight, along with Harper's Magazine, did an investigative piece into meetings that took place prior to the invasion of Iraq, and of course we're on the second anniversary of that as we speak, Dr. Ebel. You were in on some of these meetings that took place in London. Were there secret plans developed vis-a-vis Iraqi oil, and were these plans competing plans, and was there a kind of division here between the neoconservatives and the oil companies and the State Department pragmatists?
Well, I had been asked by the Department of State before the invasion, actually before Christmas of 2002, to sit in on meetings that were being held by the Iraqi opposition. And the idea was to develop an objective assessment of the Iraqi oil industry. We had our last meeting in London after the war had started. That was in April when we met in London. Actually, the reason we met in London was that it was so difficult to bring Iraqi opposition into the United States. And so because of the bureaucracy, we decided to meet in London. There was no really secret plan in my regard. It was tried to put together an objective assessment of what lie ahead. I was a bit more pessimistic about the future than was the Iraqi opposition, and I think my estimates are proven correct.
But at this meeting in London, Ahmed Chalabi, from what I understand, was advocating a sell-off of the Iraqi oil infrastructure, in a sense, privatization.
Yeah, if I haven't gone back and reviewed the papers, but it's my feeling as we came away from those meetings that the feeling was that, okay, we will the Iraqis would nationalize upstream. That really means the production end of the business. And that privatize the downstream, which would be refining, marketing, and distribution. I think that's where we really ended up. And I suspect that's where things stand today, although maybe a feeling of nationalism across the board might be more prevalent.
And in that regard, one of the people at the meeting, I believe, is fellow Al-Jaburi, who was Ronald Reagan's back channel to Saddam, And he has apparently suggested, in light of what you just said, that these plans to privatize Iraqi oil, in fact, have helped instigate the insurgency and provided the insurgents with the ammunition that the United States is there to loot their basic asset.
You know, it's possible if the insurgents felt that there was going to be a move afoot, you know, to privatize the entire oil sector, that probably would lead them to believe, you know, look, this is our oil. Why should we put it in the hands of the international oil industry? But if I had a chance to talk with him, I would say, no, that's not the idea that we had. We understood the feeling about the Iraqi people, that it'd be okay to nationalize upstream, and would privatize downstream, where you would go with put the refining and marketing distribution in the hands of people who had experience in that regard.
And was it the ideas of Chalabi and the so-called neoconservatives that he was their champion, after all? Was there an inherent idea to privatize and to basically break OPEC by making Iraq essentially an American surrogate?
Yeah. If I were to try to figure out what was behind their thinking, I would think yes, that's probably what they had in mind. If you privatize the industry, get the international oil companies involved, expand oil production in Iraq well beyond what it was before the war, and that would diminish the influence of OPEC. But during these meetings, I reminded the members around the table that the Iraqi oil sector was in very bad shape because of the absence of investment over the past couple of decades. They'd been producing their fields too hard, and that the oil fields were in lamentable shape, and that you were not going to be able to get them back in production as quickly as you would like. Some of the estimates being made by our administration as to how soon we could get Iraqi oil up and running and have an impact on the world oil market were out of touch with reality.
Well, the neoconservatives, though, were suggesting, Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith and others, that the Iraqi oil would, in fact, pay for reconstruction. They were extremely optimistic assessments.
Yeah, that would be true if you could get production back up at least to where it was before the war and probably exceeding that. In fact, I think at the end of 2003, they looked for production which would be beyond what had been the peak before the war began. But my position was, no, that's not going to happen.
And where does this idea then come, Dr. Robert Ebel, that Iraq is sitting on a lake of oil, that it's the world's second largest oil deposits?
I don't argue that point. I think that in terms of proven oil reserves, that Iraq does stand in second place behind Saudi Arabia. The question is, how soon can you get that industry back on track? I would think that three factors stand in the way. One, of course, is just the terrible shape that the industry is in. Second is looting. And third is sabotage. And you put these three factors together, the rebirth of the Iraqi oil industry is going to be very slow in coming.
And apparently Philip Carroll, the former CEO of Shell Oil USA, who took control of Iraq's oil production months after the invasion, he stalled the sell-off plan, did he not?
I think that probably he had a more realistic assessment of what lie ahead, of all the issues that lie ahead, than some others. You know, there was just general feeling, you know, well, we're going to get in there, and we're going to go gangbusters with the Iraqi oil industry, and we're going to diminish the influence of OPEC. Before the war started, I was asked largely by the European press, it's all about oil. And I said, no, it's all about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. The morning after, it's all about oil. And, of course, it was, but there was far too much optimism as to how quickly that oil industry could be rejuvenated.
Well, some of your former colleagues at the CIA that I've spoken with, Bob Baer, of course, he was an operations guy, not an analyst, and Anonymous, Mike Scheuer, anonymous Mark Scheuer felt that there was a blatant oil grab in the motivations to get into Iraq.
Well, I don't know whether I'd use the term blatant. I think that the idea was remove Saddam Hussein, and then we'll do what we can to get the oil production in Iraq first back up to where it was before the invasion, and then expand rapidly, because we know that there's reserves there second only to Saudi Arabia. But I think these individuals did not have the proper understanding of the lamentable state that the oil sector was in because of the absence of investment over the past two decades. And so they just misread how soon they could get the industry back up and running.
But it seems they also misunderstood the motives of the CEOs of the major oil companies, the vestiges of the Seven Sisters. They apparently don't believe that there's a way to take on OPEC, and it's been suggested that that no CEO of an American oil company is actually unhappy with the fact that oil prices are high and they're rising.
Well, if you look at the factors which caused oil prices to jump last year and to hold at high levels continuing into this year, look at the factors one by one: problems in Venezuela, Nigeria, terrorist threat in Saudi Arabia, problems in Russia, inability to get Iraq back up to where it was, the absence of spare producing capacity in the Persian Gulf, the growth in demand, surprising growth in demand in China, India, and the United States. And you look at these factors and you say, you know, there's something common about all these factors, probably except for the United States. There's really nothing we can do about it as individual consumers in the United States. And those factors are still with us today.
Well, indeed. Recently, an OPEC spokesman said that get ready for oil prices at $80 a barrel. We're creeping up close to 60 as we speak.
The growth in demand is expanding in large part because we have the developing countries of the world, basically China and India, leading the way, and the companies aren't putting enough money back into the exploration side. They're spending money on developing production from fields that they have already in play, but they're not replacing the oil that they're producing. So it's going to catch up with us, just as we're short of refining capacity because we've been living off the surplus for a long period of time. We haven't built a new refinery in the United States in 25 years. The OPEC member countries have been drawing down their surplus producing capacity for the past decade or so, and now it's down to 1 to 1.5 million barrels a day. So we've been living off the past, and now this past has caught up with us.
But the impact of high oil prices is felt the most in the developing world, where people in the third world can't afford to buy cooking oil, for example.
And yet,
overwhelmingly, that's where our energy comes from. So address that paradox, if you will.
Okay, well, you're exactly right, that when prices are high, it's the poor developing countries of the world that suffer the most. When prices are low, it's the developing countries of the world who are also oil exporters.
But doesn't
prices
that
decline?
Doesn't,
yeah. They are impacted financially because that's all they have. They have not spent any money on diversification of the economy, and when oil prices fall, they have nothing to fall back on, and they find themselves in great financial difficulty. So, the developing countries of the world, even though that's where the bulk of the growth in oil consumption takes place today, they are not in a win-win position. They're almost in a lose-lose position.
Well, clearly, we've seen examples of Sani Abacha in Nigeria, the kleptocracy, and clearly the oil wealth doesn't trickle down. And you've got the example of Equatorial Guinea, where you've got a dictator who is just sitting on a pile of oil and But I understand that the oil companies, our oil companies that deal with him, are happy with that situation because he gives them a better cut. So what is our relationship to these despots? Do we have any consciousness about how the vast amounts of patrimony and money are not being shared with the people?
Yeah, I think that it's a concern to the major oil companies of the world. They're looking at a program where they would publish what it's called publish what you pay. In other words, to make public information the amount of money, you know, that is paid to the host governments. That sounds fine, but for that to have any impact, the governments then have to tell the world how they spend their money. It's not just enough for the companies to be completely transparent in their financial dealings with the host governments. These host governments then have to, in turn, be transparent on how they spend their money, and they're not very likely to do that.
Well, just going back to Dr. Robert Ebel to Iraq, and among the justifications for the war in Iraq were one, weapons of mass destruction. We know that hasn't panned out. Two, to take the pressure off Israel, and it looks as if we may have a failed state in that part of the world, and that will make Israel even less secure. To secure the price, Saudi oil and Gulf oil, and secure the oil in that part of the world in general, and it seems to be less secure because I believe a big chunk of the rise in price is what they call the fear premium. So where do we stand, given that some people suggested that the Saudis, who after all did tell President Bush prior to the Iraq war vis-a-vis Saddam Hussein, either blip, or I can't say the word, or get off the pot. So are the Saudis playing us to the extent that as long as there's chaos in Iraq, Iraqi oil is not pumping, and it's the second largest supplier of oil is off the market, that makes Saudi Arabia the dominant market player?
Well, you know, let's step back for a moment and look at the United States, which consumes 20.5 million barrels of oil a day. One out of four barrels of oil consumed worldwide takes place in the United States. Where do we get our oil? The largest foreign supplier of oil to the United States is Canada. Second is Mexico.
Venezuela
and Saudi Arabia are, last year, were tied for third. So we're in pretty good shape. We're not as dependent on the Persian Gulf as some people would think. But this decade has sort of been a decade of non-OPEC producers. Russia has been coming on strong, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, but their impact on the market is going to diminish. We turn to the next decade, we're going to find that the power of oil comes back to OPEC, in large part because that's where the reserves are. Production follows reserves. And where are the reserves? There are in the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates. We keep looking for a substitute for Persian Gulf oil, but we have not been able to find it, and I would guess that we will never be able to find it.
And indeed, I believe that Russia and the former Soviet Union, their potential has been exaggerated, even though, of course, they're benefiting from the rise in oil prices at the moment. And, you know, there's many people who have support this ridiculous urban myth that somehow the producers will switch to euros, oil being denominated in dollars. But at this moment, ironically, the Europeans are getting a bonus because oil is 40% cheaper to euro countries.
The exporters, you know, do talk about the impact of decline of the value of the dollar, and probably they should switch to the euros. But I, you know, it comes up every now and then, but I don't really see them doing that.
Well, let me just ask you, though, a broader question, since you spent 11 years as an oil analyst with the CIA. I thought that the whole point of being a hegemonic power, particularly in the Gulf, was that we guaranteed the supply. You just pointed out that we don't get most of our oil. We get very little of our oil from that part of the world. However, by being the hegemonic power, you guarantee the Chinese and the Japanese, your economic rivals, their economic lifeline, in effect. And it doesn't seem like what we've done recently in the Gulf vis-a-vis Iraq has, in fact, been very reassuring. So where does our hegemonic power stand at this point?
The problem is this, that no nation, whether you are an exporter or whether you're an importer, like the United States, no nation stands in isolation from the world oil market. When prices go up, for whatever the reason, they go up everywhere. When prices decline, they decline everywhere. Good example is this, that back in the late 1990s, there was a financial crisis in the Far East, just at the time that OPEC had met and decided that they'd better start, better expand production because of growing demand in the Far East. Well, financial crisis led to reduced demand in the Far East just as additional supplies were coming on the market. Prices crashed worldwide. OPEC remembers that and said, we're not going to let that happen again. We're probably going to watch the growth in demand and then respond. We're not going to respond in advance of demand. So the world supply is going to be lagging the market. And that's some of our problems today, that with OPEC and particularly Persian Gulf countries almost out of spare producing capacity, they have nothing to fall back on. Should all of a sudden there be a surprise in demand, that can only mean then that prices will go up. We were caught by surprise last year when the demand in China went up. There was not enough oil readily available to respond to that jump in demand, and prices went up. We're looking at China again today. You know, is their growth going to be sustainable? That's the key question today, not only for China, but for India and even for the United States. Are we going to continue to have robust demand for oil, or is these high prices going to put a dampening effect on demand and slow things down so that supply can catch up? So far, we see no slowdown in China.
I thank you very much for joining us. There's obviously a lot more to talk about. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I thank you, Dr. Robert Ebel, for joining us in Los Angeles.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Robert Ebel, who's the chairman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Energy Program. Dr. Ebel was previously an oil analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency for 11 years, and he spent over 7 years with the Office of Oil and Gas at the Department of Interior. I'm now speaking with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who is the Peter Strauss Family Assistant Professor for Political Science at Yale University and author of a number of opinion pieces that I've read recently. And you are talking about, Dr. Jacob Hacker, about President Bush's so-called reform approach to Social Security is about risk privatization. It's interesting to note, Dr. Hacker, that two of the wealthiest people in the world, Forbes came out with its list of billionaires, the two richest people in the world, Bill Gates and Berkshire Hathaway, the name slips me at the moment. Both seem to oppose President Bush's economic plans, and Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway recently referred to President Bush's ownership society as a sharecropper society. So, where are we heading? Are we looking at the extinction of the middle class here?
Well, I think that we really should see the Social Security debate in a larger context, and as I've been arguing, the context that we should understand it in is one in which a lot of risk has been transferred away from government, away from insurers, and onto ordinary Americans, and most notably on middle-class two-earner families that have been struggling pretty hard over the last 20 years in a context in which wages have remained relatively constant, and they've faced a lot of expenses as a result of the rising cost of housing and health care, education cost, and the general cost of having a two-earner family in the 21st century economy. So I think we really should understand the Social Security debate as being more than just the well-being of today's age, but also about the principle of common or social insurance that Social Security upholds. And that's what I've been trying to argue in some of these recent pieces. One backdrop against which we should understand the Social Security debate is the increasing volatility or variability of family incomes. I've been doing some research that's shown that family incomes are roughly twice as unstable today as they were 30 years ago. And a lot of that increase has occurred in the last 15 years or so. And it's affected both high and low-income earners, both highly educated and less educated Americans, Americans of all races. And so it's really the case that Americans are on more of a financial roller coaster than they used to be. And a lot of the supports that that are there for them have eroded over the last 20 or 30 years. Social Security is an exception. It's remained pretty much stable for the last 20 years. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's an area of social policy that we should be very careful about fundamentally changing.
Yeah, apparently your studies indicated that income volatility has risen 88% from 1978 to 2000. But again, getting back to the central idea of trying to put this in a broader perspective, first of all, I don't understand why President Bush has decided that his legacy, his vision thing, if you will, going back to his father, is, and given that he believes that he's got a mandate for a second term, and he's got political capital to spend, as he himself has said, why he would choose to go about so-called reforming Social Security when it's pretty clear that if it ain't broke, you don't need to fix it. So,
that's a great question.
What is his motive? I mean, many people think that, in fact, it's a way to distract people from real issues. Maybe we're all getting swift-boated again, because the genius of Karl Rove's swift-boat campaign against John Kerry, apart from the fact that it got rid of Bush's vulnerability about his service, it tore down Kerry's advantage of being a war hero. But thirdly, it got us all, us citizens and the chattering class, talking about the wrong war, the Vietnam War instead of the Iraq War. So are we talking about the wrong issue here? Are we, instead of talking about Social Security, which is not in crisis, shouldn't we be talking about Medicare and Medicaid that is in crisis?
Well, I mean, I think that that's certainly the case, that where Social Security does not deserve the prominent place on the agenda that it's gotten. But I don't believe that President Bush has pushed Social Security reform as a way of distracting Americans or the media. For one thing, it's a very risky course of action for him to take. As we've learned over the last several months, when you scratch the surface of public opinion on Social Security, the very superficial support that you find initially for private accounts within Social Security evaporates very quickly when you expose Americans to the dark underbelly of the idea, that is, the risk that these accounts represent or the huge borrowing costs that would be required to set them up, or the benefit cuts that will have to be put in place if we're going to come up with the kind of money that's necessary to fund private accounts and make the program secure for the long term. I mean, the fact is that the president, I think, hoped that he could sell private accounts within Social Security as a way of saving the program for the long term. And when it became clear that that was just a bridge too far, he's got himself into, I think, quite a political jam. So I actually don't believe that this was a deliberate attempt to distract Americans. I do think there are things that are passing now, such as the bankruptcy bill, that should receive a greater hearing. And I do think that there is more involved in fighting the battle over insecurity in the United States than simply preventing President Bush from significantly and fundamentally altering the Social Security program. But I think that this actually poses a clear opportunity for critics of the Bush administration's broader economic and social policies to really hammer home their complaints about what the administration has done and the Republicans in Congress have done. And it seems to me there are two things that really have to be stressed. One is that at a time when Americans are facing ever greater volatility outside of Social Security and other programs, these programs become not less important, but more important as a bedrock foundation of financial security. And the second thing is that the people who are going to benefit from these changes, not just the Social Security changes, but the medical savings accounts ideas that the president is proposing, the ideas for new tax-favored accounts for savings and investment, and the idea of restructuring the tax code more broadly. The people who are going to benefit are not the middle-class Americans who are increasingly going into bankruptcy, not the middle-class Americans who are too often uninsured and too often financially strained, but rather it's going to be the well-off who are going to benefit from these changes. And so this is both, I think, a bad policy given the way in which our society has changed, that people are facing a lot more risk in their economic lives, and we should be thinking about ways to protect them against those risks, not make those risks worse. But it's also a policy that's going to very much favor specific segments of society, people who've already made out like bandits in the last 20 years in our economy and in the last few years with the president's tax cuts.
Well, indeed, that's why I brought up the paradox that the two richest men in the world,
yes,
are both Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, are both opposed.
Of course, when you're really, really rich, you have a certain luxury in discussing these things. But I think it's fair to say that that the sort of ordinary rich are fairly favorable towards many elements of the president's agenda. He is he has done quite well in political terms among the top 1% of Americans.
He has, but essentially what he and his party are doing is that they're using social issues to advance business goals. And I just I wonder at what point the vast middle class, as you mentioned, they're in decline. I mean, I cannot believe that anybody would consciously want to eradicate a middle class. That is the bulwark of democratic society. You know, what are these people, neo-medievalists or something? What?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there is actually a more complex political strategy beneath these changes, and it really is not about eliminating the middle class, but about both making them aware of the cost of government to increase opposition, at least to those aspects of government the Republicans don't like. So you may recall the Wall Street Journal had a piece that talked about working poor Americans as lucky duckies because they didn't pay income taxes. So part of the goal is to actually shift the tax burden away from well-off people, while making sure that middle and lower-income Americans continue to see the state as this rapacious force in their life. The other side of it, so make people angry, but the other side of it is to transform people's interests by getting them into the stock market, making them feel as if they can only count on themselves, their families, and the private sector for relief from some of these trends. So I think the long-term goal when you create these private accounts is to transform the interests of Americans and the middle class in particular. So it is the case that the outcome of many of these policies has been to weaken the middle class, and that's, of course, been a trend over the last 10 or 15 years, independent of anything we've seen recently. But I think that behind this is not a war on the middle class per se, but a more sophisticated political strategy to reconfigure the landscape of American politics. And in that sense, the goal of reforming Social Security represents, in some sense, the Mount Everest of policy challenges for the right. That was the essential element of the New Deal coalition, the idea that knit together all these disparate groups in society behind some idea and sense of shared fate. And the idea of reforming that, I think, is lurking beneath it is a desire to create a new kind of coalition, one that's based much more on personal responsibility and individual self-reliance, at least for middle-class Americans, and which showers much of its largesse, unfortunately, on the richest or most ideological extreme elements of American society.
Well, if we didn't have such a feckless opposition in this country, Dr. Jacob Hacker, then the you would think that the arguments could be made against this trend, because as we both mentioned, and it's pretty obvious, the record is pretty clear, that whatever the motives for these policies, the results are against the interests of the middle class, and that the fortunes and security of the middle class continue to decline. And whether or not people like Grover Norquist, who many think is the intellectual guru behind a lot of this stuff,
yes,
he believes that you have to shrink government down to the size that you can drown it in the bathtub. Now,
that's right.
This does give you pause. Are we, in effect, heading back to a kind of Gilded Age where you have the plutocrats and then you know, a sort of debt peonage society.
I think it's a worry. I mean, I don't think we're there yet. And I think the real question is how politically these trends can be reversed. And you brought up sort of two issues. One is, you know, what is the loyal opposition, if you will, the Democratic Party, doing on Social Security? And second, is there a prospect that there'll be some kind of backlash against Republicans electorally if they continue on their present course? I think the answer to the first question is that actually Democrats on this issue are more united and more cohesive and more coherent than they've been on any domestic policy issue of the Bush presidency. That's why the president is having so much trouble. But as we've seen with the bankruptcy bill and as we saw with the tax cuts, that unity on Social Security doesn't necessarily translate over to other issues. And what's been lacking, in my view, is the construction of a broader argument for why Social Security is so essential. It's not enough to show that the president's plan will result in a lot of borrowing or could put people at risk. I think it's also essential to say, well, what's the theory of government action on behalf of average Americans that's embodied in Social Security? And to date, at least, I think Democrats have had a hard time getting out that message. It's not entirely their fault. This is the most coherent, coordinated Republican majority that the United States has seen in the perhaps ever, and certainly in the post-war era, and it's very hard to get alternative messages out, but they nonetheless have not done that. On public backlash, the poll results have to be very bracing for Republicans, which is why so many Republicans in Congress are balking at the idea of taking the lead on this issue. The Republican standing as a party has dropped fairly precipitously since this issue's been on the agenda. And the numbers suggest that every time President Bush or GOP operatives talk about it, people like it less and less. So this is not an encouraging trend for Republicans. And they well know that this isn't going to happen unless they're able to hide from Americans the real effects of these policies, as they were with the tax cuts. And I think that this is just a much tougher road for them to take. So I think that there is some prospect that Americans will be exercised about this particular issue. But whether that'll translate into a broader backlash against the party it remains to be seen. And I have to say, based on sort of recent history, I'm a bit more pessimistic on that front. For one thing, as you well know, the political trends over the last decade or so, and particularly the last few years, has been to insulate Republicans from electoral backlash. So we used to think that maybe 100 seats in Congress would be hotly contested. Now we're down to sometimes single digits of seats that are really hotly contested and in Congress. And we also used to think that when incumbents did things that were unpopular, they faced a real risk of losing office. But now it's possible for Republicans to essentially bury their challengers financially in districts that they've drawn that are overwhelmingly beneficial to them, and with the support of a very coordinated Republican leadership. So I think that what this all underscores is that even if President Bush loses, the fact that he can raise an issue like this, one that Americans clearly are concerned about, I think one poll said that if benefit cuts were entailed by Social Security reform, only 12% of Americans would support that. So if you can raise an issue that 88% of Americans are against and still continue to win election, that I think suggests that the problem isn't the message of the opposition so much as it is the political system as a whole, that we need to think about ways to make our political system more competitive so that these kind of issues can be dealt with by our representatives in a way that is at least broadly consistent with what Americans would like government to do.
Well, but this is a part of Karl Rove's genius, Dr. Yep. Hackett, is that he's able to peel off a small but significant number of from the Democratic base. He was able to peel off a lot of conservative African Americans by putting money through faith-based initiatives to essentially bribe black preachers. He's the same in the Latino community. He's going after conservative Latinos on the conservative Jewish community with support for Israel and in the Social Security debate. By appealing to the young, the Republicans are hoping to peel off a lot of the young because they're right. Basically saying you guys are going to be hung out to dry.
Well, as you no doubt know, that at least on Social Security, the deck is really stacked against them, because if you're going to peel off a group of voters, the ones that you would least likely to go after would be the young. They tend to, I mean, this is something I lament about American politics as a relatively young scholar, that the young tend to vote in very low numbers, and they tend to be much less politically active. So Republicans are going after the mother of all voters in terms of their clout, and that's the elderly. So,
Well, they're blowing it then.
I think that you're absolutely right that Rove has done a very good job of assembling a coalition behind the Republican Party, a coalition that often is very skeptical, at least core elements of it are very skeptical of certain aspects of the Republicans' economic agenda. Those of us who are concerned about the way that the country's economic policies are heading, we often lament that voters are putting other issues before their economic self-interest. But it seems to me that the real challenge for those who want to change policy is first to make clear what's at stake for ordinary voters in these elections in terms of the economic policies that the administration and GOP operatives are pursuing. And second, to try to make and link those issues to some of the broader moral concerns that seem to be asserting primacy in recent elections. And I think this is a really fundamentally moral issue. It has to do with the question of what we as citizens owe each other, and what employers owe their workers, and what government ultimately should be doing vis-a-vis Americans' interests and demands. And so that really has to, I think, to be brought back. And I think that the idea of insecurity that's being highlighted by the Social Security debate, in which I've been doing this research around, I think this really actually does resonate with people in moral terms. They feel as if they're working hard, they're playing by the rules, but they're just one disaster away from falling off that financial cliff. And if Democrats and others who are worried about the trends of the country can articulate that concern in terms that resonate with Americans, then we may well be able to start to rebuild an alternative understanding of the role of government in this most important realm of American life.
Well, just in closing, though, it seems to me, Dr. Jacob Hager, that you mentioned the so-called bankruptcy reform, which critics have suggested is in fact making the courts a collection agency for the credit card companies who are making record profits. My sense is that what is, in terms of the political culture in this country, that essentially the fact that a number of Democrats voted for that bill indicates the nature of who owns the government, that the people in Washington that we send to the House and the Senate don't necessarily represent people, they represent capital. All congressmen and senators have to spend 80% of their time raising money to stay in, $10 million to hold onto your Senate seat, $2 million to hold onto a House seat. That they don't, given that I don't believe that they're necessarily representing people, but representing capital, and the public seem to be unaware, as people in other Western democracies are, that you vote for people in government who actually do something for you. Our people are all meeting today in Washington as we speak, talking about some poor woman that's on who's been a vegetative state. That's what they're having a special session on today. I think that the public have got to start understanding the transaction that you actually vote for people who do something for you. And the only thing that we've got left is Social Security, and they're trying to undo that. So I don't understand that. What is the political transaction in this country?
Well, I mean, there definitely is cause for concern, dismay, and even despair. But I think that it should be recognized that we've had government that's worked well for ordinary Americans in the past, and we could, with the right reforms, I think, reestablish that. I think that there is a real challenge because I don't think Americans can be expected to gain full information about what government is doing without some powerful intermediate organizations that represent their interests. And historically, those organizations were mass voluntary organizations, such as fraternal societies and organized labor. And we've seen both of those go into a steep decline. In the case of fraternal societies, they're all but extinct, except as sort of remnants of their former self. In the case of organized labor, it's dropped from a third of the workforce to something around a tenth, and even lower in the private sector. So, you know, there is a short-term, as I said, kind of political calculus that has to be considered, and that is how Democrats and others who are opposed to present policies can articulate their concerns and make people aware that their interests are really at stake in what's happening, as you say. But there's also a long-term challenge, thinking about ways in which to make our elections more competitive, to make our government more responsive, and to make citizens more able, more capable of judging what's going on in Washington, which they can't do on their own. They have to do with some kind of organizational leverage and with strong allies who are willing to go to the mat for them.
Well, so, if they were present, the politicians would respond to them rather than the lobbyists. But it seems to me the people aren't present.
Well, that's what I'm saying, of course, is that the people influence really will depend on rebuilding
right.
Those organizations that went to the mat for them,
sure.
Right next to the lobbyists for well-heeled corporations.
Mm.
And, you know, the most important way in which our government has shifted away from the great political center, I think, is in the disproportionate attention and attention paid to the interest of corporate America. You know, it's not just what happens on specific legislation. It's what's getting debated and what's not. You know, we're not debating health insurance reform. We're not debating an increase in the minimum wage. We're not debating a whole host of issues that are really vital to Americans. And most of us won't know what's not happening unless someone tells us that there's another way government can run.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Jacob Hacker.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who is Peter Strauss Family Professor for Political Science at Yale University. He's also a fellow at the New American Foundation. I'm now speaking with Harvey Wasserman, who has an article in the Columbus, Ohio-based Free Press. He's written about Senator Robert Byrd's comments on the floor of the Senate, which were greeted with howls from the Republicans and from their surrogates in television, radio, and on cable television. And it's a wonderful article, Harvey Wasserman. I have to congratulate for you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're also the author of the just re-released Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States.
Right.
And obviously, when you make analogies to the Republican power structure in this country and the rise of the Nazis, is clearly we do have a one-party state. And of course, it's worth reminding everybody that Hitler was elected to power, and then suddenly that was going to be the last election that was ever held. You've got to be obviously careful about this. So let's, you know, I mean, as we're speaking, the Congress is in special session to debate. They're interceding on behalf of somebody who's in a vegetative state that's been on life support for about 15 years. Just to touch on that, because it does seem an obscenity that
it's insane. It's insane, psychotic. Here's an administration that loves the death penalty. George Bush, when he was governor of Texas, killed 150 people. You figure if the government is 90% right, 15 of those people were completely innocent. And Bush had never had a qualm about having those people killed. We have prisoners who are being tortured in Guantanamo and elsewhere. We have sexual abuse on prisoners at Abu Ghraib. We're waging a war in Iraq for oil and for Christian prophecy, where at least 100,000 people have been killed, not to mention 1,500 American troops there. And here they're going to the mat to keep alive a woman who hasn't had an apparent thought in years, whose husband says that her last wish, or among her last wishes, was to never be kept in a vegetative state. And here the entire Congress is in an uproar. It's a complete theater of the absurd, basically, completely distracting from the fact that this week, Congress voted another $78 billion for the attack on Iraq. You have here a government that's in an advanced state of psychosis, and the analogies to Hitler are very well thought out. I mean, Robert Byrd is in his 80s. He's the leading congressional scholar on the Constitution. Nobody knows the Constitution of the United States better than Robert Byrd, and he made a very clear and studied statement comparing the rise to power of George Bush with the rise to power of Adolf Hitler. And I teach Western civilization at Columbus State Community College, and I have to say that the parallels are very, very striking. There's just no escaping them.
Well, I think there's some parallels here in terms of, let me just mention Tom DeLay, who's brought the House back, and he's the second most powerful guy in the country, and he's an ardent theocrat who wants to make the Lord Jesus the head of state.
The Lord Jesus would be appalled, by the way.
Yeah, of course, but he's not around. At least he hasn't come back to smite these people. He was on television on Wolf Blitzer on Friday, and Wolf Blitzer played a clip of the lawyer for the husband of this woman in a vegetative state. And all this lawyer said, look, this is a state matter. It's been adjudicated for over 10 years, and I don't see any role for the feds busting in here. Then Wolf Blitzer then cut back to Tom DeLay, who was listening to the statement, and Tom DeLay said, that lawyer is evil incarnate. Now, that gives you an idea of the way this man thinks and why this country is heading towards this kind of Christian fascism.
Well, you hit it.
Because this is what if you make people beyond the pale, if you make abortion doctors beyond the pale so that it's okay to kill them, if you say that anybody that disagrees with you is evil, as this guy does on any and every occasion. Meanwhile, of course, he's under endless ethics investigations. I think that is definitely an example of the slippery slope, because remember, these people who are obsessed with fetuses, I mean, they're pro-birth, but they're not pro-life. It's a moral-free ride to be righteous about a problem that doesn't affect you and that you have the right to interfere in somebody else's most difficult decisions, and in this case with this woman, the most painful horrible situation that a family could be. To turn that into a circus is obscene, but from Tom DeLay's position and the position of the Christian soldiers that follow him, this is their righteous duty. And of course, again, it's a moral-free ride, because they don't have to take care of this woman. They don't have to take care of the unwanted child.
Right, and the reality is that the most anti-abortion organization in the United States is Planned Parenthood, because Planned Parenthood at least distributes sex education and birth control, and Planned Parenthood has probably prevented a million times more abortions than the anti-abortionists have. And the reality is that these people are on a path to totalitarian fascism. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. We have had precedent in this country in the 1630s to the 1690s in Puritan Massachusetts. We had a theocracy, and these people believed that they were the anointed of God. There was no separation between church and state. They executed people at will, and of course this resulted in the Salem witch trials in the 1690s, in which 19 people were hung or crushed without trial except by a priest magistrate. And anyone who wants to view that firsthand can take a look at the excellent movie The Crucible by Arthur Miller. But, you know, the reality is that the Christian fundamentalism is really the new master racism. These people believe that if you do not share their beliefs, if you do not see Christ as authoritarian, violent, and intolerant master figure, an all-seeing, all-being, all-knowing dictator, basically, then you are somehow subhuman. And this is an extremely dangerous mindset, but we have seen it before. There are very clear parallels between the Christian fundamentalism as it's being preached today in the United States by the Bush administration with Karl Rove and the fascism of Germany in the 1930s. The parallels are absolutely striking. And what's happened in the United States, and I am a historian, I've been studying U.S. history for 40 years, is we have a unique confluence now, a perfect storm, where the corporate, the power of the corporations, has joined hands with the power of the extreme right-wing church. And this is an alliance that we've never seen before in the United States history. It started to develop in the 1960s after the Goldwater nomination in 1964, although Goldwater himself would be appalled. And what the Christian fundamentalists have done is they've taken the money and the power of the corporations and allowed it to corrupt their message such as it is into a profoundly intolerant and authoritarian dictatorship, basically. Bush is on record twice in public as saying he has nothing against dictatorship as long as he can be the dictator. And yet, in the name of this essential destruction of the American freedoms that we've known for 200 years, they are waging war overseas, allegedly in the name of democracy and freedom. I mean, to send our troops into Iraq to get their oil, at the same time preaching that it's a war for democracy and for freedom, is the ultimate hypocrisy.
But I would suggest to you, though, that Tom DeLay is actually a better example than Bush himself. DeLay is passing legislation carrying the water for corporate America, giving away the store, at the same time being so self-righteous as he is today, bringing the House back into session to grandstand over this painful issue with this vegetative woman. So
it's really the Jimmy Swaggart syndrome. I don't know if you remember Jimmy Swaggart, but
he was eventually caught with a hooker.
It wasn't just that. He was, right-wing fundamentalist up there every day preaching against sin, mm-hmm. against sexuality, all this stuff, and at night he was going to cheap motels and hiring prostitutes to dance on the bed while he masturbated.
Well, he could have gotten into the White House press corps with that.
Yes, that was a good credential for him.
Right.
But the reality is, you have a very twisted guy named Karl Rove, quite a genius, but morally utterly bankrupt, who is manipulating the media, installing censorship. By the way, this country has never had the kind of censorship that we have today. Utterly destroying the Bill of Rights. As far as I'm concerned, they're fighting over the Ten Commandments, to put plaques with the Ten Commandments in front of courthouses and all that stuff. I suggest a compromise. Instead of the Ten Commandments, which is a religious artifact, why don't we put the first Ten Amendments of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, so that people can really understand what our rights are in this country.
Well, obviously, Tom DeLay hasn't heard of the commandment, thou shalt not steal. But this is ultimately, the right wing in this country have stolen the flag, they've stolen the Bible. So people just have to wake up. They can't, this is not religion, this narrow, hateful, mercantile Christianity that these fundamentalists preach.
Christ himself would hate this.
Well, there you go.
If you read the Sermon on the Mount, doing lately.
Well, that's one of the few things that Jesus himself wrote. I mean, I'd rather go for the source rather than the...
The Christ of the Sermon on the Mount would be utterly appalled by what these people are doing in his name. Thou shalt not kill, love thy neighbor, do unto others as you would do unto you. What more do you need to hear? I mean, would this man oppose gay marriage? Never. Would he endorse the death penalty? Never. Would he support a war on other people for their oil and to impose?
Yeah, would he want everybody to have an assault rifle? I understand. We've run out of time. I thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, you're great. Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Keep, talk radio and the internet about all we got left, so keep it up.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Harvey Wasserman, who's written an article, which I believe is at Salon.com. Is that right, Lewis? Salon.com? It's worth reading about FLAP that Senator Robert Byrd created amongst the Republicans and their surrogates, referring to the analogy between the Bush administration and the rise of fascism in Europe. This program is produced by Lewis Vandenberg. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, and all previous programs are available at ianmasters.org.